Okay, so bottom of 33, hair and sleeping. Student may shave his head and keep a sika on the crown of his head. The sun may never set or rise while he lies asleep in the village. Right? So it's not a problem in these parts of the world, you know, like that. The sun never sets anyway, so the brahmachari doesn't have to worry about these kind of technical rules. So I guess this is what's meaning by, you know, we don't have to worry about the rules, right? Yeah, so either it never sets or it never rises. So it's the twilight that you're worried about. In other words, one should never be asleep during the twilight, right? But here you don't have to worry. It's either always day or always night. So this was. By sipping water, he shall daily worship both twilights with a concentrated mind in a pure place, muttering the prescribed text according to the rule. Right? By sipping water means achman. If a woman or a junior person perform anything leading to happiness, let him diligently practice it, as well as any other permitted act in which his heart finds pleasure. Some declare that the chief good consists in the acquisition of spiritual merit and wealth. Others place it in the gratification of desire and the acquisition of wealth. Others in the acquisition of spiritual merit alone. And others say that the acquisition of wealth alone is the chief good here, below. But the correct decision that it consists of the aggregate of those three. Right. So that first one is that anybody who they're inspired to do something that's within their duties, you know, that's not, you know, what's permitted to do, and they become inspired to do it, then allow them to do, right? It means they get enthusiastic to, you know, be more strict or to do some devotional activity. You know, they want to chant 64 rounds on a festival day or these things. They're not required, but they're not against the rule. So anybody becomes inspired, then that's good. You know, that's the point being made. So if someone does that, then it's a nice thing, right? So if they do it, nice. If they don't do it, it doesn't matter. And that, some will say, is that you're trying to get spiritual development and wealth, because you need the wealth for the facility, so you can do. Some will say it will be wealth and sense gratification. Others will say it's just wealth, right? So Manu is saying that, no, it's the three, that you have to have the spiritual development, you have to have the facilities, and then the engagement of the senses. So when those three are properly balanced, then everything will go very smoothly, right? Otherwise, the difficulty comes is that one could say, no, but we only chant. But the point is much of our communities are filled with what? What would normally a community be filled with? Right? What age people? If we're talking grihasthas. Productive, yes. And so you would expect younger, right? 20s, 30s, that would be your bulk because they're just coming up, getting married. But if you check in our communities around the world, what is the average age? It'll be in the 50s. So what does that mean? That means they weren't engaging the senses. Right, they weren't engaging the emotions, and so now instead of doing that first and then being pulling back from that at this age, they'd be more like in vanaprastha and giving, you know, advice and preaching and doing those kind of elements. Now they're trying to be the grihastha that they, you know, could have been when they were in their 20s and 30s. You understand? So that's why Manu's saying there's a balance, but that doesn't mean that. That takes prominence. No, balance means everything's in its proper amount, right? Just like when you have spices in a vegetable, right? Everything's balanced. There's not too much salt, but there's not too less either, right? Your other spices are there in the right amount, but they're not too less, right? The balance between your ghee and your chilies is there, so then it's not hot, but it's not heavy. You understand? So it's like that, is that how much is your desire, then that much is what's engaged. So that means you have to have that much wealth or facility to be able to engage those desires. But the point is the only purpose of having that facility to engage the senses is to engage it in spiritual activities. So therefore, the spiritual activities have to be there. You understand? So some are going for wealth, and then it's, you know, a bit late for the senses, but whatever it is, you know. Does that make sense? It has to be the proper balance, like that. So nothing is overly prominent where it causes a disturbance for the other, right? So if someone is able to, that's why it's saying here, the first, if someone is able to be more engaged in the spiritual and it doesn't bother them about the wealth and the other things, then fine, that should be done, right? Does that make sense? One might also say that, see, they did like this and now here, so that was too fanatic. But, as we mentioned before, the benefit that they got by that full absorption in that those, you know, 10, 20, 30 years will not be able to be obtained by someone who says, see, that it's not important, you know, this is too fanatic, so therefore we should just lead this so-called balanced lifestyle where we don't get that seriously involved. Does that make sense? So even that they did it like that, it's still not to be blamed. We're just pointing it out that one should try to find the balance in that. So if they had that such commitment like that, but had paid a little bit more attention to the emotional interactions and things like this, then it would have continued through. Right? You know, it would have just dropped a little bit on one level, but it would have continued very nicely on the other. Right? But as it was totally on one and not dealing with the other at all, and then now suddenly dealing with the other basically prominently, and not so much with the spiritual. Does that make sense? So the idea is how much of the spiritual that can be involved, that's the ideal. Then whatever is balance, whatever is the need for engagement of the senses, you have to have that much facility, right? Because Niti Shastra points out if you have wealth but don't use it, it's as good as not having it. So then you're working so hard for something that you basically don't have. Does that make sense? Right? So therefore it should be it's there. So wealth only has value in that it's application, its use. Right? Does that make sense? And the senses only have value in as much as they can be connected to the Lord. Right? So that means then one has to know the science. Either it's directly because this is how Krishna likes it, it pleases him, or this is the proper way, this is the pious thing that the Shastras say are rules and duties of dealing with the material energy, you know, on the Paramatma level, or at least on the level of we understand Krishna's energies, how they're interacting, and so then we're sensitive to that. Does that make sense? Okay. Honoring one's superiors. The teacher, the father, the mother, and an elder brother must not be treated with disrespect, especially by a brahmana, though one be grievously offended by them. Right? So now we're starting to get into those balance elements as we go, especially when we go into the grihastha, you'll see a lot of these. So that means these persons, one must never disrespect, right? Even though one has been dealt with very harshly by them. One just doesn't deal badly, right? So that's the, and that we saw before is that the teacher has to deal nicely, try to speak nicely, do all these different things. You understand? So there's always that balance between the two. It's never that it's always this way or always that way. Each side has what they're supposed to do, but you're only explaining one at a time, right? Does that make sense? Because if you don't explain one at a time, you don't get the full picture of what you're supposed to do. Yes.
In connection with this, for example, in Srimad Bhagavatam, Pali Maharaj, in the case of giving charity to Vamana Dev, was in opposite to this to his own spiritual.
Yeah, but he didn't disrespect him. He dealt nicely. But he just did what he felt should do. Like Prahlad Maharaj is speaking nicely. See, that's the thing is that there's a difference. We generally feel if we have that strong feeling, then that gives us the right to, you know, deal however we like. No. Strong feelings means, you know, you'll be impelled to say something, but you can still say it nicely. That's the thing. Yes.
But even Prahlad Maharaj said it nicely on the side of Hiranyaka. Kashipu, he saw it as disrespectful.
Yeah, but he's done his duty. If Hiranyakashipu doesn't see it there, then he's at no fault. Right? Maharaj Yudhishthira is called a Jatashatru, for one for whom no enemy is born. But did he have enemies? Yeah, he had enemies, because that's their view. But he didn't see anyone as an enemy. So even though you don't see anyone as an enemy, it doesn't mean that there won't be any. Right? So in other words, you're dealing nicely, but if they don't see it that way, you try to word it and deal in such a way that it's not. But just also to clear the air on that, then after the sacrifice and after that whole pastime was over and tying up Bali Maharaj and all that, then Vamanadeva asked Sukracharya, so was Bali Maharaj wrong? Right? And Sukracharya explains, no, he wasn't. You know, because he was giving him advice to not surrender to the Lord, which is actually not proper. Right? And so for him, surrendering to the Lord, then you can go past the material positions. Because in that case, he wasn't acting on the spiritual level, right? He was acting on the material. So he was giving him, for his material benefit, he was advising him. But for his spiritual benefit, then taking up that surrender to the Lord, then that was the proper thing. So Sukracharya explains it. Right? So he's, you know, he's one of the authorities. In the universe, you have Bhrigu, you have Brihaspati, you have Sukracharya. These are your, you know, known, famous Brahmins in the universe. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's, one also has to distinguish, you know, what is the situation, how they're dealing. But the point is that, so that's another thing. Disrespect doesn't mean that you have to follow what they say if it's material. Does that make sense? If your parents are telling you, you know, that not to, you know, worship the Lord and do these things, you don't have to follow that. But it doesn't mean that you're not respectful in your dealings. Does that make sense? You can deal very nicely and pleasantly, you know, because there's so many things you have a debt to them for. But at the same time, as if their advice is not useful, it doesn't mean you have to follow it. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. The teacher is the image of Brahman. The father, the image of Prajapati, the lord of created beings. The mother, the image of the earth. And an elder full brother, the image of oneself. Right? So this is the reason why you deal nicely with them. Right? So in other words, if you deal with the teacher properly, then you get the benefit of Brahman. Right? The father, Prajapati, mother, earth, and brother, you know, dealing properly with oneself.
Full brother means stepbrother,
right? Yeah, full brother. Because otherwise, Manu's giving with all the various elements. Like when we get into later, you'll get into elements that we haven't even thought about. Like eight kinds of marriages, generally we don't think about. And then there's 12 kinds of sons. So we generally don't think about these things. So what we're meaning full brother means of the first quality, means that same father, same mother. Right? Because otherwise, it may be same mother but different father, or same father, different mother. So those are half brothers. Even though, you know, you may relationship-wise be like a brother, but he's meaning here is that the full brother is the same as yourself, because, you know, the origin and everything is the same.
So is this, I know this is the chapter of Brahmacharis, but does it count for everyone else also, that your full brother is an image of yourself?
Yeah. No, see, it's, oh, okay, that's a very good point you brought up.
Yeah,
no, I'm just saying this point. See, now, when we're dealing with the subject matter, then let's say the subject applies for everyone, okay? Let's say washing your plate, okay? So now you'll go in, rinse your plate off, put it in the thing there, put your cup, spoon, and then walk away, okay? Now, if I wanted to describe the process of washing a plate, You know, which, you know, you have so many considerations there. You know, the soap and the scrubber and the water and what pressure and what temperature, what kind of, sink you're using and the drain and all the different considerations that are there. So would you find it to be, you get the full, the natural fullest explanation would come with the occasional person that's washing his plate after eating, or with the person who's washing the pots, the dishwasher, as an occupation. Right. So that's the point, is that the what is the occupation of the brahmachari? Yes. And so this element of serving the teacher, the father, that respect, you know, that element of respect, menial service, study, these aspects are something that everybody in the Varnashram system does. But it will be, its environment is most fully brought out as a brahmachari, right? Does that make sense? Just like, let's say, we'll get into taking care of guests. Now, how much facility does a brahmachari have to take care of guests? Not so much, but a grihastha has more. So taking care of guests, though brahmachari sannyasis will take care of guests, it's described amongst in the grihastha rules because they have the full facility. Does that make sense? So everything in here applies to everyone, unless it's obviously been noted. Right? You know, like there's some rules on dealing with the ladies in the grihastas that the brahmachari sannyasis don't have to worry about. But the element of being respectful to women, that is all for our ashrams. Does that make sense? So what it is where the item is best explained, because it has the fullest environment, that's where it'll be discussed. Right? So this all respect, because you'll see this will come up again. Because here with the brahmachari, there's only teacher, father, mother, and the elder brother. Right? Because at that point, he doesn't have to worry beyond that. But now, after, in the next thing, we'll see he'll get, in the next page, he gets married. There's going to be a similar verse, but it's going to take up the same volume as those three verses there, because it'll get into all the relatives and everything and how to deal. And just like he says here, the teacher's the image of Brahman, father Prajapati, the mother the earth, elder brother the image of oneself. It'll tell all the relatives and who they represent in the universe. So there's that macro and micro. So your dealing with your father properly is the same as dealing with Prajapati or Lord Brahma or the Prajapatis properly. Dealing with the teacher properly, that's dealing with transcendence or with the Lord. Does that make sense? Yeah? Yeah.
How should one deal with the full image of oneself?
If you don't respect yourself, no one else will. You know what I'm saying? If you think you look stupid, everybody, when you go out on the street, everybody will think you look stupid. If you're comfortable with what you look like, even though you look stupid, everybody will go, wow, check that out. That's the way it works, right? You ever seen what walks down a catwalk? Most of the stuff is absolutely ridiculous. But they're taking pictures and they're making orders. Why? Because for the model, whatever you put on, they look good. You understand? So if you don't respect yourself, you won't. Yeah. So here, you respect. If you don't respect your elder, but because you can't respect yourself. Right? It's not that there's ego. It's just that you're confident of what it is, your position, and what is your duties and what you should do. Right? Yes?
This is sometimes seen as a pride. Something which is
it's seen as a pride that everybody in the modern context is dying to get to gain. So if somebody brings that up, that's the person talking about the sour grapes. You know the sour grapes? You know? So they can't do it, therefore they complain about it. But if they could do it, they would not talk at all. That's the point. Because someone who actually has that can tell the difference between false ego and confidence. You know what I'm saying? You know, that example we were giving of the model, that's confidence, that's not false ego. Because false ego means it's not real. They have that confidence. They can walk like that. They can wear whatever it is. They have the confidence. Just like the man is driving the car and he's good at it, or he can race the car. It's not false ego. False ego, he'll crash. Confidence, he won't. You understand? It's a very subtle line. But because even though we talk so much about the individual and people's feelings, we actually don't know what they are. We just talk about them. You know, it's like people talking about eating, or, you know, it's like you have that group of guys that sit there and they all talk about the girls, yeah, this and that, and I'd do this and he'd do that, wow, check this, you know, and like that. But if you brought a girl right there at that point, none of them would know what to do. Like that. So it's all talk. So all this talk about community and the individual, you actually bring them to a community, they can't do anything. Otherwise, why haven't they? Right? Why haven't they? Radharath Maharaj just makes a community. You know what I'm saying? Wherever he goes, it starts. It just happens naturally. Right? But when you hear him lecture, that's not what he's talking about. He's talking the pastimes and devotional process, and right? Because that's how you cultivate. But the others will say, no, we have to work, we have to do this, we have to do that. All this nice, it sounds great, but it never happens. So that's the point, it's just talk. So that's, therefore, because it's not real, then they'll consider anybody else who is actually doing it to be false. Because what they're doing is not real. You understand? You see what you have. You understand? If, let's say, you have a mechanical brain, then, you know, you look at the car, and then you'll start seeing the mechanics of it, right? Someone else is looking at aesthetics. They are always worried about everything looks nice, and they'll look at the car, they'll see the, you know, the lines and how it looks. You see how you function. So if what you're functioning on is false, that's what you'll see in everyone else. If you're critical of yourself, that's all you'll be of anyone else. You understand? You accept your position, what you can do. You know, it has its limits, but it has what it can do. Then that's how you'll see others. Okay, they're strong in this area. They're not strong in that area. So let's work with the strong strengths. You understand? It's direct. Is that okay? Yes.
Can it be called like charisma?
Charisma? Could be charisma. Charisma has the element that there's... charisma would connotate that there is an interaction with another party, and that interaction is something that's pleasant or attractive. You know, in this case, charisma, so they'll be attractive. We're probably talking more here about panache, because panache is not... does that make sense, panache?
I don't exactly understand.
What about chutzpah? Chutzpah, there's a touch of ego there. But panache is just flair. Would flair work? Because flair doesn't depend upon the other person interacting other than appreciating. But charisma means you're dealing with the person in such a way that they're attracted. You understand? So one is dynamic in the relationship, one is not. So what we're talking here is that it's not dynamic. It's static, but we get impressed. Does that make sense? But you could say charisma, it would be better, because then you're interactive. You know, so the person who has flair, they'll look good and everybody will accept that, but it doesn't mean that they as a person will be able to interact nicely. But if they have charisma, then that means they can interact nicely. Even if they don't look good, you still like them. Like that. Okay. That trouble and pain which the parents undergo on the birth of their children cannot be compensated even in 100 years. Let them always do what is agreeable to those two, and always that he may please his teacher. Then those three are pleased, he obtains all those rewards which austerities yield. Right? So in other words, you have to deal nicely. Right? Now, the ideal is, of course, the parents are also following this culture. So then they're following, and so dealing with them properly in this, that would be your best. So then respecting the teacher, the mother, the father, then that would be the ideal. Now, if the mother and father aren't interested or opposed to Krishna consciousness, you deal nicely whenever the opportunity is there. But you don't have to be involved in, trying to take care of their material perspective when it's not of value to you, right? But if you're materially involved, then you're obliged, right? So when we say one is a devotee, it means you're acting on that platform. Not that, you can't say that, yes, you were a temple devotee in the 70s or 80s, and now you haven't been and don't hardly attend anything for the last 10, 15, 20 years. Then you can't place yourself on that same platform. You know what I'm saying? So it drops, but there's still the devotional. But how much one is involved materially without really worrying about these other aspects, then to that much degree, then where there's an obligation. Does that make sense? Yes.
How can one politely refuse to be involved in these modern concepts of sociology, management, and things without offending others?
You try your best. You know, in other words, if you're trying to do it nicely, then, you know, in other words, you try to respond to each one of their reactions to it. And so if it goes nice, then great. And if it doesn't, then, you know, you try to figure out how to do it more nicely. Right? But it's still, we can see, as Prahlad Maharaj is a pure devotee, so he's doing very nicely. But at the same time, it didn't necessarily get an ideal response from his father. Right? That, you know. But you see other occasions where it works quite well, like that. Basically, it's just that they say like that, and you can just say, you know, sorry, you know, the main thing is what we're talking, when we're talking about the principles, get down to the root of what they're actually talking about, because much of the time those who are speaking on the modern social context don't actually know what they're trying to get at. Right? They just know that you speak these particular words. Political correctness is a set of words, right? That change with time, right? Like that means nowadays they'll call it political correctness, you know, or you know, in Orwellian you call it newspeak, you know, like that, because that's actually what it is. It's just whatever is the political correct thing, you just talk like that, because even if 6 months ago it was the opposite, it doesn't matter, because that's just the way it is. So let's say they're speaking on something and caring, you know, we have to work together, we have to care, we have to this and that. So then you speak, and then you'll say, yes, it means your points on that the Vaishnavas should cooperate together and try to find a basis, you know, of working, then I find that's a very good point. But, you know, using this modern perspective of this, you know, whatever it is, I feel is that you'll miss out on the actual long-term or the actual purpose of gaining that, because then you're not looking at also the needs. We say community, but that means everybody. So you have your conservatives, you have everybody. How to work with that? And so therefore, Shastra recommends doing it in this way, and then show how that will get what it is there. And then, you understand? By recognizing the principle of what they're trying to say, because the detail doesn't work, or the detail is what the problem is, right? Because Bhaktivinoda Thakura mentions that there's no idea that's actually fully wrong, right? Because how do you get an idea? You get an idea by observing or dealing with God's creation and the living entities. So what you're dealing with in all these cases is the Lord and his energies. So you're actually not dealing with something that's unreal. You're dealing with reality. But because of the perspective of it, that's what's unreal. Right? So the basis of anything is good, right? You have, does that make sense? But the detail of application, that's the problem. Does that make sense? You have the man on the street. He's there, he's selling drugs, right, to get money. And so if you ask him why he's doing that, there'll be some underlying basis that has some value, but just that method, that's useless. You know, he's getting money for his family, or, you know, whatever it is. So getting money for your family is not a bad concept. But getting money for your family by selling drugs and therefore ruining other people's family, that's not very good. That's a detail. You understand? So therefore, you bring out the principle that is the solid, has the solid foundation. That this aspect of what you're talking about is good. But I feel that the detail that you're trying, how you're trying to apply that, the method you're using to gain that, won't be successful. And then you say why, right? And so this other method, this would be better. And then you say why. Does that make sense? So it'll get much harder for them to bring out the, okay, so we agree to disagree, or, you know, all these other little pat politically correct little phrases they have to completely sideline, you know, logic and, you know, any intelligence. Is that okay? Well, that you'll always get, because they have nothing to say, because it's just an emotion. The point is like this. Someone says this, I say that, and then it should work. And if it doesn't work, they don't know what to say.
Or change of the subject.
That'll always happen also.
Or, then I'm the authority, I'm the older one, will do the
older. No, so it says what you know, but the point is that old is simply age, the thing? What do you mean by older?
Senior,
what do you mean by seniority?
Prabhupada disciple,
what does that got to do with management? Prabhupada disciple is on the spiritual platform. So maybe at chanting Hare Krishna and understanding the philosophy, then we're not arguing here. But we're talking management here. It means there are kids who are way better managers, who are CEOs of companies that we might not even get a job in as a janitor. And I'm not joking. So what does Prabhupada disciple have to do with management? We're talking administration here. We're not talking Prabhupada disciple. Otherwise, if that's the case, then we should just make a list of all the Prabhupada disciples in the movement, who was, you know, initiated when, and just who's the oldest. And then he should be the acharya for the world. That's all. Who's left now? You know, who's the oldest, right? You know, Kirtananda's gone. Chutananda's not around. Umapati's been sidelined. So who's left that's like goes way back there, you know, like that? And so then we should just do what they say, and whatever they say, that's what we should do. That would be the top, right? If I take that logic.
But when these emotions come up,
you don't let them move from it. Then you just say, it means if that's what we're looking for, why have this meeting? You just want to make yourself feel better or something? Why do you have this meeting? So that you feel like that you're working with others? So the meeting is here just for you to tell us what we're supposed to do. So why don't you just say that? We're having a meeting. This is what's happening. And so like that. And so any questions you have are not on perspective or different proposal on that. It's simply questions on how to get this done. So just, you know, say it's like that. But you'd say it very nicely, yeah, you could. I mean, in these kind of meetings, if it's a management meeting, I would. Because then present it as it is. Stop using all this fancy language that we're all here and we're all working together and all this and that. All it is you're the senior man. You have the plan, you know, and you're trying to make the plan clear to us who are supposed to carry it out. And do we have any questions on how to get it done? That's it. You know, but don't try to present this as if we're all just here cooperating together and we're all equals. You know, just make it very clear that it's in a very, you know, structured manner of getting this done. That's it. You know, it says we want truth and straightforwardness. That's truth and straightforward. So therefore, if that's the way it is, okay, great. But then that also means that if it doesn't work, you're responsible. You know, and if I don't carry it out right, I'm responsible. But if I carry out properly what you say and it doesn't work, you're responsible. So, you know, it should be clear. This is management. This isn't sentiment. We're not sitting in a bookstore discussing poetry. you know, or we're not sitting on a, you know, on a French cafe, you know, and you know, with our little berets on and sipping coffee and discussing, you know, existentialism or something. You know, we're discussing direct management. Try it. The worst that can happen is silence, change of topic, or an emotional outbreak. You only have these three, right? Is there something else? Oh, they could walk out of the room, but that would be probably a subdivision of the emotional outbreak. You know what I'm saying? Same time as be careful. If you're worried about your position in the management structure, then be, you know, careful how it works. Because, you know. Yes.
If there's a conflict between senior and junior, and they both approach you and you're responsible to decide, not being them, how can you know whether it was because of disrespect of the junior or because of the arrogance of the senior?
You just have to ask questions and see what's there and try to bring it to the point. See, if it's just the junior's fault, then you'll bring that out. If it's the senior's fault, then bring out the duty of the junior at the same time. You know, in other words, how he could have handled it better. You know, in other words, you'll emphasize the junior's lack, but it'll be in the context of the senior should have done like this. You know, but that's not directed at the for the junior. In other words, you have to say it in such a way the junior can't respond to that and use it against the senior. Right? But at the same time, as it can be pointed out. You know, so it has to be very nicely. And then for detail of how the senior should deal, if need be, that would be discussed in private. Right? Does that make sense? Yes. Then you have to catch the junior and then tell them that this won't be tolerated, you know, and point out why. Because the senior's duty is the senior's duty. It's not their duty. So what's their business talking about how they should have done their duty? You didn't do your duty. So you stick to your duty. They'll stick to theirs. Otherwise, it's very easy for everybody to want to know everybody else's duty. That's just straight bottom line material. Because I think I'm not sure, as Vishwanath or Baladev point out, that people criticize others to prove themselves superior. That's the flavor in it. If you, the person who is critical and always finds fault in everybody, and that's all they do, that way they feel superior by finding the fault, right? But the fault doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the situation. There's just a fault, right? You know, it's just like, that the president is there, you know, and they're running for candidacy. So, you know, in high school, then, you know, they had a crazy party and they were, you know, they were behaving badly. What's that got to do with him now when he's, you know, in his 40s and that? That was like 20, 30 years ago. What has that got to do with anything? You know, why all teenagers aren't crazy or, you know, what is it? What to say, found the fault, therefore I'm a better candidate. You know, it's just a standard method that's used. It's the politically used. That's why, you know, previously it was you speak about your own good qualities and what you're going to do, you know, and like that. But now as much as you're just talking about how the other person's not going to do very well, like that. So it's not a very good system, like that. So. The point is that therefore it's like this is not going to be tolerated. There's etiquette here. You have to respect the seniors. The point is they're in that position. They have that authority. That authority comes from the Lord, right? The position carries the authority. Otherwise, why does it work? Why does the boss of the company carry that authority? That's because that's the way God made it. But now, as the boss, he has duties, and he's supposed to deal in a certain way that he takes care of the juniors. So now, if he does that or not, that doesn't mean that the juniors can now not perform their duty. Right? Does that make sense? So it's by them not doing their duty doesn't correct. You know, you have a saying, two wrongs don't make a right. Yeah, so therefore it's not going to be tolerated. That's all. And them and whoever else is involved, you call them all. And depending upon how it is, call them one at a time or call them in a group. Be careful that if you call them in a group that they don't get together as a group and get stronger. Right? Because then this is, you're dealing with beta, which means to separate. Right? And so with this can also go consequences. If you don't do this, then these are the consequences. So you just have to judge how these different people are involved. Are they, as a group, strong or not? If they're strong as a group, deal with them individually. If they're not, then you could deal with them as a group. Right? Or break it up. Some individuals, the rest is a group. Right? Like that. Does that make sense? Okay. Acquiring knowledge in times of distress. He who possesses faith may receive pure learning even from a man of lower caste, the highest law even from the lowest, and an excellent wife even from a base family. Right? So one who possesses faith, one who has that knowledge, has the proper understanding, one who understands the principles, can know how to take something of value from wherever it may be, right? Because here is that pure man of a lower caste, because they may, no, it's just like, just for an example, if you really want to know why cigarette smoking's bad, ask a chain smoker. Right, they can give you much of the time the most reasons why you shouldn't be smoking. But they're addicted, so they can't stop. You understand? But you can get something very valuable from them. Does that make sense? So that's the idea, is that someone may be there, but by their experience and all these things, they may know a lot of things like that. So that's the point, especially if, you know, they've been around a while. You know, but anybody who deals in the area can tell you what's not good about it. You know, if you deal with them properly and all that, then they'll give you straightforward answers. If you don't, then their ego will come up, you won't get. Right? The highest law from the lowest, you know, because they know. Someone who breaks the rules all the time actually knows the rules the best. You know? Someone who never breaks the rules sometimes doesn't know all the rules. I've seen that myself in the school, is that there's one kid who never did anything wrong. So then after being in the school like for 10 years, one day he's doing something that you know, absolutely is not tolerated in the school. And I ask him, why is he doing this? And he didn't know it was wrong because he had never been around all the kids that were all bad and were doing that. Just one day spontaneously start doing that. You know, like that. You know, they just don't know because they never heard. So sometimes, therefore, you can hear the highest law from the lowest. An excellent wife even from a base family. The family may be base, but it doesn't mean that the person's not good. Right? Because later we'll see in the 12th chapter that one may be born in a low family by mental offenses. Right? It means your activities are good, you know, how you speak and deal is good. Everything's good, but you mentally, you know, deal improperly, you know, with somebody or something, that can put you into a lower family. So they may be actually a high quality person, but because of that, they're born in a low family. Does that make sense? Yes. That means on the spot. But it doesn't mean that there won't be the reaction that you won't be born in a lower family, because the lower family thinks like that. So therefore, you'll be born in that situation where one could think like that.
Is it like the only reaction, or is it more to the mental offenders, or improper dealing or the mental offenders, or is it some more reactions to that?
No, no. It's just this is a side point, you know, that this is just being given to show how one could be from a base family but actually be a nicer person. Generally, you see base family or base people, but you do have that occasional where there's that person from that base family who deals very nicely. So then you can understand it's because of some mental offense, like that. You understand? So you're talking about you think something mentally that's, let's say, violent or not nice. You get the reaction for that violence. You don't get. But it does mean that the consciousness is dropped to that level in that area. So therefore, the reaction would be you would be placed with those who have that consciousness at that level. You understand? So it's not that there's other things. You don't have to worry. Like that. Does that make sense? Excellent wives, learning, the knowledge of the law, the rules of purity, good advice, and various arts may be acquired from anybody. So in other words, where they are, you can get. Not that it's, you can get anything anywhere. No, the person knows it, you can get that from them. They don't know it, you don't learn from them. Right? It's that easy. Right? And various arts. Arts you get from who knows the art. Right? Doesn't mean they're a nice person, especially when you're dealing with arts. You can be a fabulous artist and be a disgusting individual like that. That's there. Just like you can be a fabulous businessman and be, you know, an absolute, you know, demon. Right? I once saw a poster. It was, I think, back in the 80s or something. It was about a movie. And it had two like, you know, business tycoons. You know, real attitude, you know, you could tell that they're really not nice people. But, you know, dressed well and, you know, the whole thing, they're there. And it says, I think the movie was, good guys finish last. And then the subtitle was, we're the winners. You know, meaning we're the worst. So, does that make sense? So, therefore, it was something you can learn from those places, but you just have to be careful. Right. The advice is good, you take it. Doesn't matter where it came from. You know, the laws of purity, if they're correct, you take it. So in other words, you know, and so if somebody tells you that, like on, I think it was on Sankirtan, one devotee was telling me that they were distributing books and then they had become kind of, you know, it wasn't going well or something, and so they didn't have that enthusiasm. They're just kind of there and trying to, you know. And just some Karmi lady, he didn't know who she was, just walked up to him and said, you know, if you had a little bit more self-confidence that what you were doing was of value, you know, it would work better for you, and then walked off. So this is an example of that you take, this is good advice. In other words, it's obvious to the people on the street, you don't believe that what you're doing is worthwhile, therefore why should they? Right? So then this lady just came up and said, hey, you know. So this is, right? Because ultimately Krishna is the guru. So then how he gives this knowledge then, right? Okay, nice sticker brahmacharya. But if a student desires to pass his whole life in the teacher's house, he must diligently serve him until he is freed from his body. Right? So that's the point. If you want to be, don't want to get married, then you have to serve the you know, whatever it is, the teacher, the temple, or whatever is your situation. It's not that you don't want to get married, but you've been around for a while, so therefore now you can just kind of sit back. No, that doesn't kind of work. No. Brahmachari means it's brahmachari. A brahmachari who serves his teacher until the dissolution of his body reaches forthwith the eternal mansion of Brahman. So in other words, the brahmachari who just does his duties nicely until he finishes his body, automatically he's raised to the transcendental platform just for that. He'll be liberated just for that, you know, and then you add whatever devotion is on top of that. Right? So this is the meaning of when Prabhupada says the brahmachari is already 50% of the way back to Godhead, right? Well, the while the Grihastha has 25% chance. You know what I'm saying? Because it's already, he's just working for the transcendental position. So even if he's not so qualified, his position is, puts him so much farther ahead. You know what I'm saying? While the other one, you're dealing with material energy. So according to your qualification, right, then you will be, you know, more advanced or not. Does that make sense? In other words, the situation is different. So here it's just if they do that. He who knows the sacred law must not present any gift to his teacher before the Samvartana. But when, with the permission of his teacher, he is about to take the final bath, let him procure a present for the venerable man according to his ability. All right? And so then these are given as items. A field, gold, a cow, a horse, a parasol and shoes, a seat, grain, even vegetables, and thus give pleasure to his teacher. So in other words, whatever he can give, that is what he should be doing, according to his ability, whatever facility they have, like that. So he's saying when he's about to take, not afterwards and then they'll work it out later. No, before the final is there, that gift is given, then Samvartana, and then he, like that. A Brahman who thus passes his life as a student without breaking his vow reaches after death the highest abode and will not be born again in this world, right? So here, it means if he's not a devotee, Brahma Loka, just like the yogis. If someone's a Naistika Brahmachari his whole life, he'll go to Brahma Loka. That's the material response to that, right? The devotee, you go back to Godhead, but it has that potency. So the yogis, the Brahmacharis, like that, they attain Brahma Loka. Yes.
From Bhagavatam, there's those who worship Hiranyagarbha or Garbhodakasha Vishnu, they don't go back to Godhead. They have to wait until Brahma.
Yeah, well, that's the meaning of this Brahmaloka. That's why we use it as a first step. This understanding how the universal form, Hiranyagarbha, is in the situations that we're dealing with, right? In other words, we're not going to change what we're doing because that would please Krishna, right? There has to be something more close to why we're doing it. So then you can look at it from that angle of the universal form, right? That's what we were discussing before, this Paramahamsa understanding, the masculine and feminine principle working in the energies and that situation that you're dealing with. So in that you can see, but so that will break the illusion that it itself is what is of value, but by habit, by practice, will still be attracted or attached to it. But it starts to break that down. And then as it breaks down, then it's, okay, what should we be doing? What's the Shastric thing? Right? So that brings it to the Paramatma level because the Lord is in control of it. Rather than just how you would see the proper interaction of the energies, right? Then, but at one point it has to come to, this is what's pleasing to Krishna. Right? It's just natural, because otherwise one may think, oh, well, I've connected it, so then that's done, right? It's just like the person is, oh, I'm not fanatic, so it's fine. You know, you always have that element that they're going to try to rationalize not moving forward. But the point is whatever the state, one has to move forward from there. Right. Krishna consciousness is dynamic. So it's not that, okay, well, this is okay. It's okay now. But as time goes, then it won't be okay. Right? Just like, you know, when you're a kid and you eat and slobber all over yourself, nobody minds. In fact, they think it's cute. But when you get a little older, then, you know, when you're five and do that, then it's kind of like, you know, what's wrong with you? Does that make sense? So it's the same thing, is that when seeing on that level, it's that is a solid beginning. That's why it's the second canto. You know, it's for how to see the material energy in connection with the Lord. But as it goes, then we see is that third canto, fourth canto, they start adding in these other elements of what would be proper, but in connection to the Lord there, you know, of rules or, you know, different things like that. Like Kardama, that's basically your next story. You know, and so he wants to get married, But his purpose is to get freed, you know, from the material world and become the Lord's devotee. But he has these material desires, so therefore he wants to get married. He approaches the Lord about it. As a good brahmachari, the Lord makes an arrangement, right? So he's engaging according to his desire, but he's still turning to the Lord for it. But before that, you're not even seeing the Lord as Bhagavan. It means you know Bhagavan is there. It's that is his potencies. He is expanded as Hiranyagarbha. But you're still looking at more just the interaction of the energies. So someone who's on that level will go to Brahmaloka, because who does Lord Brahma associate with? What form of the Lord? Do you know? The thousand-headed, the Purusha, yeah. Means you know, he associates with him. So that's because that's your how you say, practice of seeing in that way. So you go to Brahmaloka, where that's the standard vision. And then when Brahma leaves his body, then you go with him. So from here, that's a long time. But once you're there, it's only 100 years. You know, and now 51 years is running. So you'd only have to wait 49 and a half years. Right, because we're in the seventh Manvantara. So that means half of the day of the Brahma. So that means... Okay. So discourse three. We made it. The Grihastha Ashram. So now for 3, 4, and 5 will be the Grihastha Ashram. All right, so this is only part of 2 was the Brahmacharya Ashram. So now 3, 4, and 5 will be the Grihastha Ashram. So now we'll first have is then some Vartana, because it's only if the Brahmacharya is going to get married, because he'd say, well, this is Brahmacharya, this should be in the Brahma. No, Naistika ends the Brahmacharya. So if he's going to graduate, that means graduation is to get married, so it's the opening of this. Topic 5, the rule of bathing, graduation. The vow of studying the three Vedas under a teacher must be kept for 36 years or for half that time or for a quarter or until the student has perfectly learned them. Right, so 36 years, you'd learn all 4 Vedas, right? Or half of that, then 18 years, you would have learned different 2 Vedas or 1 Veda. The idea is that, you know, generally at least whatever it is that you've committed to doing, you've learned, right? So we can see before is that they would spend 36 years as a brahmachari, right? And that's if they're a brahmin when they join when they're 4. So they would graduate at 40. Like that. Of course, in other ages, then you're going to live to 1,000 years old or 10,000, so it's not a problem, right? You know, so it's not that, you know, you lost any time. But in Kali Yuga, you might be a little more worried, but, you know, you do have those who are getting married when they're 40, so it seems to work, right? Student who has studied in due order the 3 Vedas, or 2 or even 1 only, without breaking the rules of studentship, shall enter the order of householders, right? Prabhupada said first-class brahmachari makes a first-class grihastha. So the good brahmachari, he gets married, right? Because if he's not a good brahmachari, better he doesn't get married. Because if he's a bad brahmachari, he'll be a worse grihastha, like that, you know. He who is famous for the strict performance of his duties and has received his heritage, the Veda, from his father, and is so inclined, shall be honored, sitting on a couch and adorned with a garland, with a present of cow and the honey mixture. Right? In other words, the Samvartana. Rule of bathing, because at one point water is sprinkled, I think twice, on the student who's graduating and his feet are washed. Right, then he shaves, because before, if he's already shaved like we will be, then it's not a big deal. But there's also the rule that they don't shave anything, so they have matted hair, and so if they're getting married, they would shave that, right, like that. Unless you're from Jamaica, of course, right. But then they would, get married, you know, then they can wear sewn cloth and, you know, leather shoes, all these different things that they wouldn't use as a brahmachari, like that. They get a garland and all, and then they graduate, like that. So the law of marriage. All right, so that's why he's been bathed, that's why you call him a snataka. Snataka means one who's bathed, like snan, so a snataka is one who's been bathed. Yes.
This could or should be done also when they are moving. Like normally,
generally, well, we only follow when Upanayanam has been done, so therefore, if we've done the Upanayanam ceremony, because in there then the teacher is saying that he's going to take up this vow, and in the graduation ceremony he says, I have completed this vow, like that. So then they go together. So those students who have gone through the Upanayanam ceremony, then we do Samvartana for them. Otherwise it's not so important, but it could be done. It's not that it would be a problem, but it was something. It's that then they leave the brahmachari ashram. So we do that before the marriage, like that. Because otherwise they get married and they're still a brahmachari, may not be so, work so good. But yeah. Okay, now topic 6, the law of marriage. Right. So that was a quick topic. Having bathed with the permission of his teacher, and performed according to the rule, the Samvartana rite, on returning home. A twice-born man shall marry a wife of equal nature who is endowed with auspiciousness. Right. A damsel who is neither a sapinda on the mother's side nor belongs to the same family on the father's side is recommended twice-born men for wedlock and conjugal union. Okay, so sapinda means having a common ancestor within 7 generations. And the same family, sagotra, means the having the family line traceable that's back to this one of the Prajapatis. See, when you have, what do you say? In India, then anybody who's from a cultured family, they can say what their gotra is, right? Gotra means that you can take your lineage all the way back to one of the 21 Prajapatis, right? So we're talking a long time back. You know, we're talking billions of years, but they know the line. You know, so there'll be whatever it is, the Gotama or Kasyapa or this or that or like that. So that's standard. Generally, any cultured Indian, you can ask them what the gotra is, they know. So in other words, the girl shouldn't be from the same gotra, and sapinda on the mother's side should not be someone who you can, 7 generations you can go back. Because the gotra is the father's side, right? So now the mother has come into the family, right? So technically that becomes her gotra, but that wasn't originally her gotra. So this other person's family is therefore, on the mother's side, is not going to be the same gotra. So then you can say, well, hey, they're not sagotra. Right, but they may be sapinda, that you might, going back 7 generations, you know, there might be a relative that's common. So if there is, then that would be too close, right? Because the idea is that you're getting at least 7 generations before that blood is mixed into the family again. Otherwise, if it's mixed in too early, then you start to get, it would be called inbred, like that. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's why a cultured family means one who knows their gotra and knows their family lineage back 7 generations. If they don't know 7 generations, a good family won't marry into them, because who knows, they might be sapinda. Right? Like that. In conducting himself with a wife, so this is, you know, inappropriate arrangements. Let him carefully avoid the following families, be they ever so great, right? You know, in other words, social status is great, but one should avoid them. Be they ever so great or rich and kind, horses, sheep, grain, or other property. Kind means cattle, cows and that. Namely, one who neglects the sacred rites, one in which the Veda is not studied. Let him not marry a maiden who talks excessively and disagreeable or has red eyes, right? Because if she has red eyes, it means she's always angry, right? So if it starts like that, it's probably not going to end very good either, right? So this is a dvija. A common person doesn't really necessarily worry about these things, right? So this is that. If you notice all the dots, I've taken out quite a lot. Because we wouldn't worry so much about it. So So yeah. So basically, the main point is there is marry a wife of equal nature, right? Like that. That's the main principle. Yes. You don't have to consider so much, but what does so much mean? Doesn't mean not at all. It means not as much, because, what is this, 3.7. Okay, if we go into the back, 10, 5, 3, 3, 386, oops, 35, 36, okay. This is what we've removed. Namely, one who neglects the sacred rites, one of the Vedas not studied. Then one in which no male child is born. In other words, it's just there's only a run of sisters, because then you'll get a daughter instead of, like that means that side of the family is very powerful. One, members which have thick hair on the body, because if the hair is too thick, then there's too much of kind of like the mundane, or there's some lower natures there, like that. Those which are subject to hemorrhoids, phthisis, weakness of digestion, epilepsy, or white or black black leprosy, right? Let them not marry a maiden with tawny hair. Tawny means not black. So you guys are finished, right? Nor one who has redundant member, means one of the limbs doesn't work. One who is sickly, they're always sick. One who is neither with no hair on the body or too much. No one who talks excessively and disagreeably or has red eyes. In other words, someone with a bazillion wax, watch out, right? No one named after a constellation, a tree, a river, no one bearing the name of a low caste, nor of a mountain, no one named after a bird, a snake, or a slave, no one whose name inspires terror. Let him marry a female free from bodily defects, who has an agreeable name, a graceful gait of a hamsa or of an elephant, a moderate quantity of hair on the body and on the head, small teeth, and soft limbs. But a prudent man should not marry a maiden who has no brother, nor one whose father is not known, through fear lest in the former case she has been an appointed daughter, and in the latter lest he commit sin. In other words, if he doesn't know these two, you don't know the gotra, or you don't know she's been appointed, so her son will go back to the father, or it may be that they're sapinda. Like that. Okay. So does that make sense on, we don't worry so much, so now are you cool with? One who neglects the sacred rites, one whose Veda is not said, let him not marry a man who talks excessively, disagreeably, or has red eyes. So that's, you know, like that. And then Prabhupada says about checking the charts. So you know what I'm saying? So whenever we think, oh, so many rules, this is not so many rules. You want to see so many rules? Look on those back pages. We're coming up to these rites. A whole chapter is left out. Right? I read to you, you know, what kind of Brahmins you can't include. So that means basically anybody who is not doing that, they're following a Brahminical occupation exclusively and nicely. Does that make sense? So there's a whole list. So when we say we don't care for the rules, we don't worry about all those rules that are based on more on the material considerations. But those that are based on human culture, we don't ignore those. Otherwise, if we ignore those, what's left? Being an animal. Right? And we don't mind, since that's our birthright, you know. It means a Malecha can confidently say it's their birthright to be one. Right? Does that make sense? So when he says not so much, it means how much Prabhupada talks about being careful. But we tend to, means Prabhupada said this much, those are rules. He said not so much, so we don't have to follow the rules that Prabhupada gave. Yes. Yeah. No, we fully accept. It means even these other rules, we know what's behind it. In other words, why would there be all these bodily symptoms unless there is something that has created it, right? As we said, you're born in a low family, but it doesn't mean you'll have inauspicious marks, right? You're just, the inauspiciousness is born in that family. So therefore, a girl, even from a low family, the girl may not have any of those faults, because it was some other karma that she ended up there. Does that make sense? But when these other things are there, there's something wrong. Like that, there'll be something wrong in the character. But this is for dvijas, not for the common person. Because for the common person, this is the way everybody is. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
Yeah. And not following all these rules, it's not necessary because we are devotees. So.
Yeah, yeah. The point is that the devotional element is the most important. Like as you see, Manu itself is saying, is that knowing the Veda and knowing the purpose of the Veda, and someone who therefore simply chants japa and knows the purpose of the Veda, he is the topmost Brahman. Right, so that's Manu's already established that in the beginning. So if you have less time and you're just going to establish something, that's what you want to establish. Then from there, then you can introduce all these elements that are given in the Smriti, you know, all these other literatures. But we've been given already the Smriti of Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, and these like this. So. But these other elements of the Vedic literatures, Dharma Shastra, Sanskrit, Nyaya, the Puranas, and all these other areas, those can be added, Ayurveda, yes, these can all be added as we understand that the purpose of the Veda, being Krishna consciousness, is the actual essential point. If that's there, then you can approach these with no problem. But if you think that this somehow or another stands on its own without devotional service, and I know devotees who have, they get into Sanskrit or they get into Ayurveda or they get into Vastu, and then that takes precedent over the devotional consideration. And so nice, it's a pious occupation, but as a devotee, better that they never bumped into those scriptures. Because then there's the doubt whether they will be able to be properly Krishna conscious, right? So all these things are there, and Prabhupada said for the leaders. So to be a leader in ISKCON means you would have been practiced in the chanting and all these other elements, and you would have brought yourself up to a particular standard. Then at that standard, now you can study this and you won't be distracted. But this study is not for the general devotee. It's just not. You know, just like, let's say, music, you know, study of technical music's not for the general devotee. It's only for those who understand music. You know what I'm saying? So it's just the same way. So someone can say, no, but then it should be for everybody. But if so, well, not. Who wants, only, this only will mean something to the leaders. It won't mean something to others. You know, why do they care? They like the girl. What do they care if she has too much hair, too little hair? You know? I mean, now the girls have no hair, you know, except for, you know, so how do you tell? So they're happy. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't matter for them. So then you're simply looking, are they a devotee? You know, are they committed to devotional service to the same degree that you are? Right? But you should also, you know, check, you know, what about economic status? What about raising of the children? What about education for the children? You know, like that. So those, if you check those, then things would basically, you have that, you're done. You know, that's all you have to do. And so you just add into it that the charts are good, then it should work. Like that. Yes.
Say, well, well, we would like to have a seminar on Manu Samhita. What is the proper way to have such a seminar?
Then you take out of it those things that generally apply to everyone, which basically means important, you know, prominent points from the first six chapters. So all these verses here that you see with a little squiggle before it, take those verses out of the first six chapters, and then there is a little bit in, I think the ninth, or wherever it is, on rules on husband and wife, there's a few important points from there, and basically you're done, you know? That would keep them quite busy. Because they don't need to know, you know, how to work out a boundary dispute, right? What is it called? But temple presidents do, you know. This test goes, can we do Sankirtan here? No, but it's just it's in the outskirts of our town, but it's not actually in your town. So, you know, how do you work that stuff up? So that's for them. It's not for the common devotee. Does that make sense? Yes. Okay.
And then there is also the way how to avoid many frustration between the devotees, even though they cannot know it exactly, but when leader use his knowledge, mm-hmm. it's very practical for the devotees around.
Yes.
You can make some arrangement with his work.
Yes, yes. No, that's the point, because see is that if most devotees will approach marriage from the Western paddhati, which is you're attracted by looking at them, then you have a basis, right? And then if you talk to them and you like talking with them, then it's 100% sure, right? But that's only one of eight, you know what I'm saying? Is there that mutual attraction? So it's ideal that that's there and it's strong, because then there'll always be that kind of... But the other seven also have validity, right? As a basis just to get a general idea, right? And then some will say that there's other aspects other than these eight that are important, so that you can tell, you know, how the planets fall on each other, and, you know, when you put the two charts on top of each other, where the planets are and how they interact with each other and stuff like that. So there's considerations. Because the common person is not looking for beyond that. So if you've already worked that out as an authority, and you say, you know, and you can see that, okay, at least materially there's a good basis, then if they know what they're doing to some degree, then the interaction, the marriage should work. But if those charts aren't good and they don't know what they're doing, then you can basically say it's 100% it won't work, like that. I've seen one example where the charts are terrible, but the two persons are from very traditional Indian backgrounds, and and so they make it work, because they just, you know, it's like, what do you call it? Give an example is Subhadra. When she's discussing about marriage with Krishna then, because Arjuna's been there, right? And she's seen, but, you know, she's kind of wondering about this sannyasi. You know, why he keeps kind of looking the way he looks and stuff. And then Krishna comes to her and says, you know, Arjuna has been here in Dwarka for the last 4 months. She's going, not possible. If he was here, you know, one, Balaram would know about it and he'd invite him or deal with him. And two, I'm Yogamaya, I would know, you know. But Krishna is using his Maya, so which is above every, you know, even here, even though he puts himself under Yoga Maya, he's still above, right? And then it's like, no, he's been here like that, and, you know, doing all, you know, like that, and, you know, like this. And then she starts to figure out, oh, you mean this guy, you know? That's how it is. He's much more clever. He starts out so... What do you feel about this arrangement of Balaram that you're going to marry Duryodhana? She says, you know, it's her point is that whoever she marries, she'll be a good wife and she'll deal with them as her husband. Says, you know, it's kind of like, So then he says, but, what about someone else, let's say, just for example, like Arjuna, and it's kind of like, now you're talking. So the principle is that girls are trained, they have their duties, and whoever the husband is, it doesn't matter who it is, they'll deal with properly. You know, like you had the one princess, and because she had poked out Chyavana's eyes, when it worked out that she had to marry Chyavana, you know, he's old, he's wrinkled, and he's blind, and she didn't mind. You know, I mean, of course, she'd rather marry a younger husband, but whoever they marry, that's who they're going to deal with, right? You understand? So if there's that kind of training, and then whoever the wife is, you're going to take care of them. So then that kind of person, even if the charts aren't good, they could make it work. And I haven't discussed one thing here about devotional, so no one should pull in that, no, but we're devotees, it doesn't matter. People divorce not because they're devotees. Right? They divorce because of something mundane. So we're saying here is mundane-wise, but I have never, when I've been sitting with them and they're discussing something, I have never seen that they agree on any one point. They always argue, but the argument is very subtle, very pleasant. It'll just be a look, it'll be a small comment. They don't agree on anything because their charts don't match. But because their duties, they have a very successful marriage. Right? That I would not in any way recommend that to anybody, and no one should use this as an example that it could work, because unless you have people that are from these traditional Indian families, I mean, they go back, these are the ones that they can say their full lineage and say everything like that, and they're traditional and they do everything like that. So don't, never try it. Because some people say, no, but if the charts are bad, it can work. I mean, this is the only couple I know of like that. The only reason they did it is because in their family circles, there's no devotees. So they're the only devotees in their family circles. So they wanted to marry each other. Like that. Because otherwise, if there had been others, they probably would have picked someone else. You know, someone who the charts did match. Yes?
There is similar.
Yeah, about the chart, yes. There's a lot of things in that, in those purports about Prithu Maharaj, where it talks about the training of the girl, training of the boys. Very nice stuff there. That's where you get the thing about if the boy is sense-controlled and sensitive to the needs of the woman, and she's chaste and satisfied, then the marriage will work. That's the basis, right? That's their endeavor, right? In other words, the charts match, and that's their endeavor, then it will work. In other words, the charts are only the situation. Your endeavor is what makes it function. Does that make sense? Yes.
It looks like in Kshatriyas, they're giving their daughters in charity to other princes.
But they're the same. But the main rule is she'll marry a wife of equal nature who is endowed with auspiciousness. Now, are those princesses of equal nature to the prince? They're both kshatriyas. They're both nobility. And is she endowed with all auspiciousness? Was Draupadi endowed with all auspiciousness?
Yes.
Yeah, so then what's the problem? Jambavati, so Jambavan, who is Jambavan?
He's a bear for a gorilla. Prabhupada calls it gorilla. It's a bear from.
And yes, so that's the thing. Jambavan is Chiranjeev. He lives as long as Brahma. So he's actually a great personality. But somehow or another, he's born as a. I'm not sure if he's a Kinara. I think he's a Kinara. There's Kinaras and Kimpurushas. Both of these are. Nara means, man. And Kim means what. So a Kinara means what kind of man is this? You know, it means, you have a have a, you know, how you say, a, you know, an animal head and a human body, you know, like that, or a Kimpurusha, the same kind of thing. So there's some slight difference between them, the Kanaras and the Kimpurushas. So, but they're from that kind of nature. He's one who is an intimate associate of Lord Ramachandra. When they're doing the lila of going across to, making the bridge across to Lanka, Jambavan is in ecstasy, and he's talking about how in the previous yugas, you know, Treta Yugas, when Ramachandra's come, how he got across to Lanka. You know, and that time he did it like this, and the time before that like that, and then there was another time like this. And so he knows all these things. So he's not an ordinary gorilla, you could say. So he's not one of these silverbacks that's sitting here like this. He'll look human. You understand? They look human, but there's something about them that makes them. So also because they're these Kanaras and Kimpurushas, they're of a higher nature. They're not humans. They're from the Antariksha. Does that make sense? They're in between heaven and earth. So they're powerful. So they can take normal forms also. Right? Just like Hidimbi. She's a Rakshasi, but she can also take a normal form. When she takes a normal form, then she looked pretty good. You know what I'm saying? Because when she was sitting there, when Kunti woke up, then she asked, you know, how is it you're here? And like that, why is a girl like you here? She asked, are you the forest guardian? Are you the forest, you know, deity here? Because she looks so proper. But a girl that would look like her wouldn't be out in the forest. She knows she's not supposed to be there. So why would this girl? You know what I'm saying? So they can do that. So then it's not that Jambavati would look funny. Right? It's not that when you walk into the bedroom and she looks like a gorilla, then you know, okay, she's not in a good mood today, okay, so just kind of tiptoe out, you know, before, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, you don't have to worry about those things. Because these basic things are there. They are of equal nature and the personalities have auspicious qualities. So you know that Nala and Damayanti, they're both from the Kshatriya class, they're from good quality of Kshatriya class, they both have auspicious. Nala is the most beautiful living entity in the universe after Lord Vishnu. And Damayanti is the most beautiful female in the universe after Lakshmi. Right? So he's even better looking. But so they're gonna match. You know what I'm saying? So they have these things, so that's, and then you have on top of that the element of the training, so it'll work. You know, even if the charts don't, but they have the auspiciousness in that. So generally they do, they check all these things like that. But occasionally then they can do it outside of that. If the girl's highly qualified, then they may have, if the father hasn't found anyone, then the girl can choose. But the father has to approve. So that's what they call it Swayambar is. It means the girl chooses under the father's direction, right? So in other words, you know, either she'll decide or he'll decide that there's a, you know, who can be there. So it can only be for certain qualified people like that. When Damayanti had her Swayambar, then the demigods came. You know, Agni, Vayu, they all came. But when they got there, then they figured out that she's only going to marry Nala. So knowing that as a demigod, you know, if they were there as Indra, Vayu, they wouldn't have a chance. So when she came out to see, everybody there looked like Nala. Like that. I think even the Kshatriyas didn't even show up because they just knew it was a no-go. She's only going to marry Nala. But the demigods thought they'd give it a shot. So she's looking at, and there's hundreds of Nullas. So because of her training, then she went to each one, you know, and looked at him in the face and like this, until she found the one that blinked. Because demigods don't blink. And so when he found that, then she put the garland. Right, so then the demigods were very happy because here's a girl who, she could marry any demigod, you know? but she wanted to marry Nala. It worked for everybody except Kali Raj. He was not impressed. He was thinking, what? All these great demigods are there, and she picked a human being? So that's why he went down and found some way to curse him. You know how he did it? He waited for an opportunity that once, when he ate, when he washed his feet, he was in a hurry, didn't wash his whole feet. He only washed the front part of his foot, so the heel didn't get washed. So through the heel, he entered into his body. And so for 12 years, he was under the influence of Kali. So he became like a dwarf and all kinds of things like that. So if you don't wash your feet after, you know, doing something that makes you impure, then Kali can catch you. That's the rules in the Shastra. Might even be in here. Okay, so nature is equal, so they don't have to worry. But they have the duties to do that. Does that make sense? But, you know, we lowly members of the Kali Yuga who don't actually even know who we are, let alone anybody else, then better to check the charts. You know, in other ages, they knew exactly their nature, and therefore, if you know your own nature, you can study and understand someone else's. So, and they knew what to look for. So they weren't just looking for the physical beauty. The auspiciousness meant that there was good qualities. That's what that would be noticed. So you're looking at the feminine nature, right? And the auspiciousness of the form indicates good qualities. Well, nowadays, even if the form is auspicious, it doesn't indicate good qualities. It may be just there's only that much piety left that they physically look okay. But as a nature, then they're not. So that's why you need to check the charts. Like that. Okay. Yes?
Could you just repeat those 8 different aspects? Because you mentioned one which for a chart.
I can't give you the names of them just now.
Well, you mean the one from the Jyotish, right?
Like, yeah, means yeah.
The matches should be eight.
Yeah, means it checks the attraction, it checks the what you do to relax, what is your inherent underlying nature. It checks all these different kind of things. So that simply says the basis, what's there. Then you have to also, there's some other few things to just see that the planets aren't going to, you know, disturb each other. And then you have, means in other words, the environment is good, but it's still fully dependent upon the endeavor of the two persons, whether it'll work. So you can have a fabulous arrangement and still make it not work. You know what I'm saying? It's just a matter of, does that make sense? So it's a matter of how well you deal with it. Just like we said before, you can have someone who's not a very good cook, though you put them in an excellent kitchen, it doesn't mean that they'll cook any better, right? You know, so the point is it's the endeavor is the actual thing. But that just makes it that for your endeavor, you'll get a full result. If the charts match, for your endeavor, there'll be a matched response. But otherwise, you may endeavor, and it doesn't mean anything to the other person. So they'll consider you're not endeavoring, though you are. So that's why you want to have a matched nature, that what you would consider the right thing to do, they would also consider that. You know what I'm saying? Because just like you mix Rakshasa and Daiva. Daiva wants to keep everything clean and orderly and everything nice like that. Rakshasa really doesn't worry about it. You know? So then it'll annoy them that someone's always cleaning up. And for the Daiva, it'll always annoy them that the other person's such a slob. So therefore, if you have two Rakshasa, they're happy. Or two Daivas, they're happy. You know what I'm saying? So it's just a basis. So why have an element like that, that you're always fastidious about your environment and the other person couldn't care less? Why would you want that as something that's going to be in your face 24/7 for the next 30 years? Do you have that tolerance and that broad-mindedness to overlook that? If you do, hey, go for it. But if it would be a consideration that might bother you, that's why the charts are there. Does that make sense? So that's all that's for, is to make sure that there's a basis there. But it doesn't mean that by having that, that now everything's perfect. No, it still is up to the two to endeavor to make it work. Right? So that's why then training is necessary. Right? You know. So if the leadership understands this, then they can give that training beforehand. And they can also, as they go in the marriage, then give them pointers in that. Because generally for a few years, it takes a few years to work all these out. Because it sounds great, but then when you go to apply it, then you find out what you're really dealing with. You know, so after 2, 3 years, 4 years, they basically get it figured out, and then they can run on their own. It's very rare they would need some input. But, you know, before marriage and for a few years after, then a lot of input's needed. So if the leadership understands this, then you're the person who can give it, and then automatically that puts you in the position of an authority, because they don't know this. And if they follow what you say, it works, then they're going to be convinced. Then you don't have to use, you know, I've been here longer than you, or I'm the Prabhupada disciple, or any of these kind of things to establish your authority. You can tell them how to make the marriage work, and they don't know, so automatically your authority. And if you can do that, then you must be a good manager. Does that make sense? So that's the... Yes? No, but they're kshatriyas, and they do their duties as kshatriyas properly. You don't hear of any complaint by the citizens about Duryodhana's management of the kingdom. You'll hear complaint how he deals with the Pandavas, but not like that. So they knew what they were doing. As far as a kshatriya. So he's a qualified as a kshatriya and qualified as a husband.
But like, wouldn't it be a major topic then for the wife and the husband? Like, suppose if Duryodhana would get married to Subhadra, and then he would be all the time against Pandavas and Krishna, and then she is devotee, and it's like one of the major issues.
Krishna worked it out, no?
Yeah.
So that you don't have to worry about that. No, but theoretically, the point is, as a husband and wife, would it have worked nicely? Would he deal properly with her? Would she deal properly with him? Would their children be kshatriyas? Would they have a different view on raising their children? Would they have a different view on the economic position that they would have, or the social position? So in all those, no, it wouldn't match. So here you're talking about Krishna consciousness. Right? So, as a devotee, then you consider the Krishna consciousness. Does that make sense? So you have to understand that equal nature means the Krishna consciousness and the material situation, because you're not marrying the Krishna consciousness. That's the thing. We make the mistake that we're marrying two souls that are Krishna conscious. No, you're marrying two bodies, gross and subtle, that happen to have an inclination in Krishna consciousness. So what is that gross and subtle body? That's what you have to match. You know what I'm saying? Because otherwise you may have very enthusiastic, fired up devotees, but because materially it doesn't work, so then they give up that super enthusiastic Krishna consciousness because they think that's what's getting in the way of their marriage. Right? I even saw one girl drop Krishna consciousness because I pointed out that she was very serious about Krishna consciousness and the husband wasn't. And because she was so committed to following everything very nicely, then that's why she was going to stick to that. So in other words, what I was trying to point out to her is that the husband, who used to be very serious and wasn't at the time, he should become more serious. So then somehow or another it stuck in her mind that if she wasn't so serious, then her married life would go better. So then, because that marriage fell apart, she married a karmi. You understand? So that's why you have to be very, very careful in dealing with this, to not too much emphasize. Because the point is it's not the Krishna consciousness that's getting in the way. It's the material nature. So those two persons didn't match. You know, they were musicians. One was a pop singer, just naturally talented. The other is one of these ones that went to Vienna, went to school, knew everything by the, you know, like this and that. And so the husband, who was the, you know, the formally educated musician, couldn't tolerate that with all his teach training, he wasn't as good at music spontaneous as his wife. And so he was always trying to control her and put her into this and that. She couldn't tolerate that because, you know, you just sing it. You don't have to go through all this like that. So they couldn't work together. So he only married her because they only married each other because they were both musicians. But not that there was anything more than that. And then on the musician platform, it didn't work. So the problem was is they had married the wrong person. Not the Krishna consciousness, but then she mistakenly thought it was she was too Krishna conscious, so that's why it wasn't working, so therefore marry a karmi, and then now it's great. All it is she married someone who is a similar nature, that's all. You understand? So you're dealing with very delicate things here. So you always have to be able to balance them. Right? Because ultimately the girl wants to be married. You know, so when she gets too desperate, there's the chance she might marry anything, right? So you want to avoid bringing in that element that Krishna consciousness is an impediment to married life, because otherwise she'll take it. So you always have to be very, very careful on dealing with these things, right? So we're discussing it here quite mechanically, because leadership should understand that. But in application, then you have to know what's the nature of what you're dealing with. And then apply it in that way. Right. Is that okay? Yeah. Okay, marriage rites. Topic 7. Now listen to the brief description of the following 8 marriage rites used by the 4 varnas, which partially secure benefits and partially produce evil, both in this life and after death. Right? In other words, some give good results, some give not so good results. They are the rite of Brahman, Brahma, that of the gods, Daiva, that of the rishis, Arsha, that of Prajapati, Prajapatya, that of the asuras, Asura, that of the Gandharvas, Gandharva, that of the Rakshasas, Rakshasa, and that of the Paisachas, Paisacha. So what's legal? Which is lawful for each varna, and which are the virtues or faults of each rite? All this I will declare to you, as well as the good and evil results with respect to offspring, right? Because marriage is going to be reflected in the offspring, right? Generally speaking, the modern concept is just the husband and wife, you know, love each other and it's great, then everything's already perfect. No, there's the element of what effect it'll have on children, right? So no one thinks about the children, just as when they're thinking about divorce, they don't think about the children, right? The parents are fighting over the kids. The kids would rather they don't. Kids never like it, okay, then Monday through Friday, I'm with the mom, and on weekends, I can the dad or the other. They think this is the stupidest arrangements ever. But the parents somehow really sincerely think these are great arrangements. Or the mother doesn't like the father, and she tries to get complete custody so that he can't even have anything. The kids think this is really, really disgusting.
But what to do then? If they have to share
the time? Why do they have to get divorced?
What is karmi?
Why are you worried about the karmi, Sarah? The point is why didn't it work out? It means they don't know what they're doing, or they married the wrong person. So where is the point where there's a responsibility to know what is proper and to know who to marry? So even though divorce has been going on now very, very efficiently, probably since the 60s, you know, but has anybody figured out that there's standards and how to work it? People write some books, but it's not required. You know what I'm saying? Nobody's trained. So therefore, they end up like this, okay, and they mess up their kids. But we're devotees. We know better, so we can learn these things and we can avoid these things. You know what I'm saying? The point is whatever situation is the best for the children, that's what should be looked at, not what's best for the feelings of the parents and their hate for each other or stuff like that. What has that got to do with reality? It's like, what's going to be the best situation? Who has the best situation for the kids to grow up in? You know? And the point is as the children should never have seen any fighting between the parents, either when they're in the womb or after they're born, so even if they do separate or divorce, they still shouldn't see any fighting. Children don't see the fighting of the parents. It's just the way it is. So therefore, they should learn to be behaved and follow that. You know? So whatever's the best situation for the kid, that's the situation they're in. You know, in other words, if one of the parents is in the situation where the best schooling or best arrangement or social environment for the kid is in, that's where they should be. And then when it's the vacations and that, then they can be with the other. You know what I'm saying? But this forced thing, you have to go at this time and you have to visit this time, kids don't really appreciate that. They just don't. You know what I'm saying? So it's not in consideration of the kid. That's my point. Is that the point was, is the modern situation, the kids aren't what's considered. It's only the relation between the husband and wife. That's all there is. And so what kind of children they'll get, or what kind of, how do you say? What kind of situation will be for the kids if it doesn't work? That they don't, it doesn't matter. That their natures don't match, therefore their kids won't be a matched nature. That they don't care about. Just as long as they love each other, then that's good enough. You know what I'm saying? And then when it doesn't work out because they're not matched, now then they fight over the kids as if it's like, you know, the house and the car and the, you know, the Picasso or something. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? It's just a very different perspective. Does that make sense? Yeah.
What is the definition of varma sangana? Is it just a matter of varma sangana?
No, it says that. We're coming up to a chapter of that. There's a whole chapter on that. Varna Shankar just means the nature of the parents are different. See, varna shanka means you'll get the nature of the thing. If the garbhodhan's not there, means it won't be a purified womb. So you may get something of similar nature from that's of an impure background. That's all. Yes.
That just illustrates your last point. When Radha was 8 years old, he heard a discussion. And when he was crying, and because of that, they really sorry. They're not going to get their voice.
Okay.
And that makes them learn for 50 years.
Because the point is that's why there's the ruling that you don't divorce. Not that somebody couldn't, but you don't divorce because if there's the element, if you can't divorce, what technically for an intelligent person would that mean? What would be the consideration? So if you only have one shot, you're going to make sure that you marry the right person and you're qualified for it. And when you are married, even if there's difficulties, you're going to give it your best effort to make sure it works. But if you can divorce, then you could kind of marry anybody whenever there's an opportunity. And if it didn't work, hey, it doesn't matter. You know, you can try again. Like in a lot of times, the modern ones, they discuss, you know, hey, well, this, why, him, wow, okay. Yeah, we'll try it. If it works, great. And if it doesn't, hey, you know. They don't care. So that's the point, is it's given rise to that nobody takes it seriously. So we look at it as the whole thing is the ritual is not getting divorced. No, it's not getting divorced is supposed to make us more aware of the process of getting married. You know? But the problem is we always catch a certain, there's a certain aspect that we ritualize, overly ritualize, and that's the whole thing. Right? The whole thing is whether they got divorced or not. Now, not whether it was a good marriage, they raised the children properly, this and that. Those aren't our considerations. It's just they didn't divorce or they're divorced. You know, that's the whole thing, right? Like, if somebody doesn't know how to run their marriage and screws up their kids and that, we have no rulings on it. But if they get divorced, then, you know, can't be a, you know, ISKCON this or that or so many things. But we've said that if they get divorced, this, then this is what's going to happen to them. But did we ever think that, what are we doing to make sure no one divorces, right? Along with that rule should be, this is the training someone has to go through before they get married. These things, the charts have to be checked. These are our standards we're looking for, you know. And, you know, this is the way that they have to be trained to deal within the marriage. Now, if they've done all that, and we've been there to support and give that backup, and still they are insistent on getting divorced, then we can say, okay, then we don't want them as a leader in our society. But the other way is just we're showing authority but taking zero responsibility. Because there's no one who's training anybody or worrying about, you know, who's getting married. You know what I'm saying? I think in Chopati they have a committee that deals with the marriages. So they'll check these things. Right, and I don't think they have any problem with divorce, because they put all these other things in place: qualified people, equal nature, training, and so they don't. So therefore, they don't have to deal with the divorce issue. But in some zones, they'll make it. They put all of it on the divorce, thinking it'll stop it, and it just keeps going on. Does that make sense? So that's the difficulty. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And all these things, and always the response was, or in most of the cases, they did these things for our sake, not for their sake. Meaning that they were always thinking that we are saying all these things, like check all those things which you were mentioning, and get the charts done, and work on all these things before you enter the ashrama. So they did it because they knew that then we will have peace from our authorities because we did it, but it's completely unnecessary.
But did it work?
So far,
yes, so then they should be smart enough to figure out maybe there's some validity in why you did it.
But then it feels so bad, like for me, because I always thought like I could see, you know, the way how they were looking at me and responding to it, like, okay, we'll do it so that you can rest in peace, but otherwise you don't understand.
And they're only saying that, if you actually dig deeper, they're only doing that so they can get married. Like that. So it's not even to please you as an authority. So
yeah.
It's just they want to get married. That's the point. Before they get married, you can train them in anything.
Yeah.
But once they're married, somehow or another, they know everything. It's an amazing thing. It's like that.
It's like every single couple, they think like their marriage is made in heaven, and we don't understand that they are...
Wait till you get to the kids. They dropped out of the heavenly planets. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the point. That's why the authorities know that without this training, then, you know, they'll think it's made in heaven, and then they'll suddenly figure out it wasn't, you know, that it came from a... There was another personality that was in charge of the arrangements, right, like that. So then... but here, then, it'll just go, and they can go on in their illusion it's made in heaven, because... It was made according to the authority of heaven. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point, is that one has to appreciate that the parental rasa means it's not always appreciated. That's just the way it goes. You have the authority, but it doesn't mean they'll appreciate. That's just the way kids are. You know? So you know it's better for them, so you do it. And if they do it just for, at least that's better than not doing it at all. There's some zones where they couldn't care less. Like that. You know, you head a little south and then they just marry whoever they want.
Or they would follow these things like in front of us, but then secretly they would come out.
Great. So at least they follow it some of the time. So after a while, once that passion wears down a bit, then they'll start to notice that the ones where they followed, that's where it was working. Where they didn't, that's where their problems are. You know, so like that, slowly, slowly. But it doesn't mean you stop doing it just because they don't care. Because the point is they're only doing, so you can look at it this way. They're only doing it because you said, as the authority, and you're only doing it because the authority says. Prabhupada says, the Shastras say, that's where you're doing it. We're not doing it for you idiots. We're doing it because that's what the Shastra says. Like that. You know what I'm saying? If they want to throw that in your face and just say, hey, it goes, the knife cuts both ways. You're only doing it as the position of authority, and we're only working according to authority. Like that, it doesn't have anything to do with you. Yeah, but then that's welcome to being a parent. In the modern context, generally, I've seen a general phenomenon is when the kid turns 30, so that youthful exuberance is gone, and they have their own children, then they start to notice that what the parents were saying was correct. But that's 30 years. So, you know, how long you been doing this for? 17. Okay, so then you only have another 13 to go before they start to realize, hey, they knew what they were doing. You know what I'm saying? So you're over the major part. Now it's on the downhill, you know, kind of, you know. 17's gone, 13 left, right? So you're doing okay. Just hang in there another 13, then they'll start going, I think you guys knew what you were doing. So that's the meaning of parental rasa. It doesn't necessarily, it's all one way. You always make the arrangements, and they accept the arrangements, but don't necessarily appreciate them, you know? The mother cooks breakfast and cooks the meals, and so she's working in consideration. The kids may appreciate it or not. It's just the way it is. Is that okay? Okay, so we'll break now for a few minutes, and then. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jainitai Gaura Premanandi.